discussions over lunch. Yeah? Discussions, lunch, questions, come on. Anybody got any questions? No questions? I don't believe you got no questions. You mean you agree with Buddha? Come on. Hang on. Yeah, go on, give her the mic.
So, Venerable, when you said that positive minds or positive state of minds are ingrained in reality, so if I would ask you kind of in debate language to give me the reason.
What, darling?
If I would ask you to give me the reason. Like,
why are they at the core of your being?
Yeah, like one clear. So
okay. First of all, we start with its Buddha's findings, so let's see if we can see the logic of it. This is the point, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. This is my way of putting it, okay? Extrapolating from the Buddha's teachings. Become cushions. Oh. I did ask for more cushions. What do you think? We try.
Thank you. We'll take some out.
We can. How about that? That'll do. We can do that. Okay.
That's good.
Now I need the rest under my feet because my legs don't extend.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I know I'm so ridiculous. I can't help it. It's a bit better. Okay. I can see some of this. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. You're such a dear mother. Okay, so let's see if we can, using Buddha's understanding of the mind and how things exist, let's see if we can sort of see some logic to that. Okay? The point that Buddha's making, that the delusions, which are not true, they're lies, okay, can be removed. Let's start with that one. Okay? So how can they be removed? Let's just use a really simple example. So we've got to take, to understand this, we've got to take, even just as a theory, that the neurotic states of mind have an aspect of being liars, conceptually based and therefore lies, therefore not in sync with truth, right? You get that point? Take this on board. So if I say to you, I have got two thermoses in my right hand, would I be speaking the truth or a lie? Am I? Talk to me. Look at your notebook. Is it the truth or is it not the truth?
It's not true.
Okay, so how do we... This is how we now establish reality. This is emptiness, basically. So let's just do this as an exercise. How do we know it's not true? Prove it.
Well, I can cognize or I can see through my direct
see what?
Experience.
Right, but how do you know one or two? How do you know that? What's two? What's one? Where do we establish one and two? Sorry? Right, they're words, but so how do we know, what's two mean, mummy? How do we know what two is?
We have two phenomena.
Yeah, but how do we know it's two? Who says it's two? Now, this is a really important point. Who says it's two?
The system of communication.
Thank you, it's a system called mathematics.
Yes.
It's that clever Arab fellow, Baybak, who changed that silly Roman one of all the letters. How delightful of him. So would you agree it's some clever person, this is the way Buddha talks, who didn't invent numbers. He took the energy of the universe and he articulated it and called it numbers. So it's actually a natural law, but we gave it language. Well, do you see that point? So from that perspective of conventional truth, we can all agree that one is one and then two is one plus one. You've got two ones. We can all establish that because we recognize the English language, we accept the meaning of the words, we understand mathematics in that sense. So this is the way Buddha would say you establish things existing conventionally. And he says everything in the... Incidentally, by the way, now, everything in the universe exists like that. This means, this is the emptiness teachings, there's nothing out there from its own side that exists in and of itself without being labeled by the mind. This is the ultimate teachings of wisdom in Buddhism. And, you know, they spend another 30 years studying this and 1,000 lives and meditating on it for the penny to drop. So, conventionally, it is an incorrect statement to say there are two thermoses in my right hand, right? So that's a concept, isn't it? But isn't also a concept there's one thermos in my hand? Would you agree that's also a concept?
It is.
Would you agree it's also a concept?
It is not.
Don't jump ahead yet. Would you agree it's a concept?
I accept.
They're both concepts. They're both equal in being thoughts in my mind. Do you agree?
Except.
Stop laughing.
Sorry. I accept.
So listen. They're both thoughts, right? This is the point I'm making. Everything in here is a view. So they're both viewpoints. But we know conventionally one of those viewpoints happens to be in sync with conventional truth. But don't think it's out there truth. It's truth we've established. You with me? And one of them is not true, is it? So let's say I go, oh, what's your name?
Radek.
Who?
Sorry, it's not common name.
Just say it.
Radek.
How do you spell it, darling?
R-A-D-E-K.
It's Radek.
It's Polish.
Where's it come from? Oh, that's a nice name your mummy gave you. Radek. Okay, listen, Radek. Okay, sorry. So, Radek, I'll go, oopsie-daisy, you're absolutely right. There is one thermos in my right hand. I kind of forgot, you know. So now, what happened to the thought there are two thermoses in my right hand? Now, what's happened to it?
Well, by establishing there is just one, you eliminated the other possibility.
Eliminated from where?
From the concept.
From my mind?
Yes.
So that thought's gone?
Yes.
It's gone, hasn't it? Disappeared into smoke. Gone. Disappeared, yes? Disappeared.
Yes.
Right? What made it go?
The realization of
being. The truth.
Yes.
That's how you get enlightened. No, I'm not joking. But you've got to take on board this Buddhist view of the mind that whatever goes on at the conceptual level is a concept. Can you get my point?
Yeah.
Including anger, including jealousy, including ego grasping. And they are much harder to see because all we think of them as emotions, and the worst part is we think that they're true. And this is what Buddha says keeps us stuck in samsara. So to unpack our mind to the point where we can establish that the conceptual story that Radek is the cause of my suffering, how dare he do that to me, I do not deserve it, those are thoughts of anger. Wouldn't you agree they're the philosophy of anger? Buddha says there's no truth in that. He's not saying you didn't punch me. He's not saying that punching is immoral. He agrees with you. But he says in Rabina there's a cause for him having punched you, and it was because you punched him in the past. So you can't say I don't deserve it. And I'm sorry, this is heavy when it's a little, sweet little, cute little baby 3-year-old being dumped on by a pedophile. We don't like hearing this, but this is the point. Everything that goes on in the mind is based on a concept. So also the concept that my mother made me. Also the concept that my mind is physical. Also the concept that depression is that in the chemicals. All the things the Buddha would argue with, which doesn't mean these things don't have a way of talking. We can bring them together and discuss it. But these are fundamental conceptual things that Buddha would say from his own experience is how reality is. So by changing your mind and being in sync with this, but don't just believe it, don't just stuff your mind full of a new bunch of thoughts, which is what belief is. You've got to prove it to be true. And the proving things to be true is what a realization is. Are we communicating, people? This is the way that the system works, you know. Therefore, delusions are adventitious. They are extra bells and whistles that don't belong, therefore can be removed. And that's the Buddha's fundamental finding. That's what nirvana is. So now, let's go to the virtuous states of mind. So if, let's say, Radek had, in this particular life, has achieved his own nirvana, he's removed the obstacles to liberation from his mind, he's perfected his realization of emptiness, he's removed all the delusions, let's just say, okay? So how would he be? Forget Buddhahood, that's more advanced. Forget Heim, he's a Buddha. Just think, Radek's an old, you know, he's an arhant. He's done the first wing of the bird. Okay, let's say, how would he be? Think of it simply. He'd be blissful. This is a surprise to us because, you know, this is another whole discussion again. That the mind being joyful and blissful is a totally natural state of a mind that's unencumbered by neuroses. We can prove this. When Serena and I are relatively harmonious, not even saying high realizations, but reasonably loving and reasonably kind. Is that not when our mind feels peaceful? Isn't it? And pleasant and connected and easygoing and happy and smiley? That's the natural state of virtue. Virtuous states of mind naturally are blissful. Naturally. You with me? So now, why are they indestructible? Now, this is different. If this monk here is a... You are a Theravadan monk? He learns different teachings. Buddha has many different teachings in the world, and he would say, when you achieve your nirvana and you die in that... He's disappeared. Where's he gone? He's embarrassed. You should be sitting in the front row. You're a monk. What? You should be. Are you happy there? Okay. So he would be taught in the Theravadan tradition, there are many different interpretations of Buddha's teachings. He would be taught that when he achieved his nirvana in this life, he'd be the same. He'd be blissful. He'd be full of love. How could he not be? Because there's no longer a separate sense of a poor, pathetic me that sees you as not this and that. There's no longer those delusions there. But he'd just be in, he'd be in sync with other beings. He'd be blissful. He'd be kind. He'd be loving. He'd be compassionate. He'd be wise. All these qualities. But because when he dies, he would say that he'll disappear like a puff of smoke. There's nothing left of him. And as His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, we Mahayanists have a problem with that. So there's different views in the Buddhist world, okay? So the Mahayana view would be that when Radhik achieves his own nirvana, this is incidental piece, by the way, he wouldn't actually disappear, because the Mahayana view says consciousness is indestructibly forever eternity. It can't possibly ever end. So there's many different interpretations in the Buddhist school, okay? So when he achieves his nirvana, he will die in that life. He won't come back, but he won't disappear either. He'll go into a state of subtle bliss. And the Mahayana say Buddha will come along and tap him on the shoulder one day. Say, okay, baby, come back onto the Mahayana path, become a Buddha, so you can, you know, come and help other sentient beings. So there's different interpretations. But the point I'm getting at is this. When he's removed the pollution from his mind, when he's removed all, as they call it, the obstacles to his liberation, which means he's realized emptiness, he's perfected it, which means he's removed from his mind the subtlest delusion, the neurosis, the ego grasping, and therefore all the other branch delusions, they're gone, gone, disappeared, because he's seen the truth, and they've driven the lies out. His mind is blissful, but he's also infinitely loving, infinitely wise, infinitely compassionate, infinitely joyful. I mean, I said that. Infinitely, all the virtuous qualities, because they are relatively in sync with reality, because they're in sync with interdependence. In other words, when you've achieved liberation and you've stopped all the delusions, you don't turn into sort of like flatliner with no feelings and no anything. You would be joyful, blissful, loving, compassionate. So the Mahayana view would say that's conventionally your natural state, because they're in sync with interdependence, which is conventionally how reality is. So they're indestructible. He would disagree, maybe, depends on where he's at, but that's the different views and the different teachings, okay? Are you hearing me?
I do, although...
What? Although what?
Although if I would say that positive minds are ingrained in reality...
I can't hear you, Radhik.
If I would say that positive states of mind are synced with reality because they're interdependent, I could say...
Relatively, until you realize emptiness, not totally, but relatively, yeah. I'm saying.
But wouldn't it be the same the case with, I mean, negative minds are also interdependent. They come through the many different causes
no,
and conditions.
No, that's not what I'm saying. They are interdependent, but you're not in touch with interdependence.
Oh, okay.
When the negative ones are there, you're in touch with nonsense. So
I got it.
You understand? That's the
yes.
point.
Yes, yeah. It's just language.
Can you see?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions, please? Before we continue, we are continuing. The person in front of Haim. Not Haim yet. Come on. Go on.
I just wanted to ask, where do we start? You've given us loads and loads
yes,
to work on.
Exactly.
And with the debate you asked us to have over lunch,
yes.
There seems to be more questions and confusions. And it occurred to me that perhaps... Yes. You know, if you could explain where we start.
Yes. I sort of said it before. Who was the person who asked me? Where are you? A female person. Where is she? She must have gone. Yeah. What's your name, please?
Ian.
Okay. Well, if you wanted to start today without going to a Buddhist course and signing up, which would be a typical way to start, because then, you know, like, how do I start learning music? You find a teacher and go start learning music. But if you want to start immediately, it would be the very first thing, entry level into Buddhist teachings, like junior school, is begin to harness your body and your speech. That's the first level. It's sort of like, I put it this way, there's a Tibetan packaging of the teachings that really is very helpful. And if you like, the very first level is giving you the entry level, which is controlling your body and speech, which means control your behavior. Be disciplined. It would mean living in vows. So why would you harness your body and speech? And let's go into this in more detail. It's quite helpful. Why would you? Because if we take Buddha's view that our body and speech are just like, that's my way of saying it, the servants of what goes on in our mind. Would you agree with that? Do you understand? So then, given that delusions are pretty rampant in most of us, even if we're nice people, then the body and speech are going to be like the servants of your anger, the servants of your depression, the servants of your jealousy, aren't they? So then they, even if, forget about what they do to others, because that is what causes us to harm others, but look at what it does to us. Short term, if I'm angry and I come home from work and start, you know, blaring onto you about that wretched colleague and the wretched this, then I'm just stirring up my anger. So there's no way I can actually begin to do the real job of being a Buddhist, which is to be your own therapist, which is to start to learn meditation and to learn to begin to focus in here, because I'm stirring it up all the time. So a marvelous technique, and it sounds kind of boring because we think, you know, our grandma tells us to behave nicely. Like, you think, oh, I want to be a Buddhist, I want to meditate. You can't begin to really see your mind until you control your body and speech. You see what I'm saying? So that really would be the first step. Almost you'd make a decision. Okay, from today, I will not say one bad word about a single person, including Mr. Cameron if you don't like him, or Mr. whoever it might be you don't like, including your ex-door neighbour or your ex-wife, because that's one thing. We mightn't run around raping and killing too many people, us people in this room, but we really are good at the mouth. You see what I'm saying? We don't even consider it negative in our culture. It's not considered immoral. You don't get sent to prison by saying naughty words. It's only if you use your fist. But look at what words do, you know? Do you understand what I'm saying? This is not to be underestimated. It's almost a surprising answer. But this is established in the Buddhist system. The very first level is control your body, control your speech. Best way to do that is to live in vows, and there's another whole level there because Buddha really is loving vows. He says vows and morality, you make a commitment to not lie, not steal, not kill, not jump on other people's partners, etc., etc. And it has a very powerful effect on your mind when you make a strong commitment. It makes it deeper for you because everything you think and do and say leaves a karmic imprint. So this is a really powerful way to start. And then it's to, you know, it's up to you. If you like the Buddhist idea, you go to a Buddhist center. It's pretty reasonable. You do a course, start hearing the Buddhist teachings, start learning simple techniques of meditation, and then let it all unfold. See where it takes you, you know. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Good. Who else? Steve. Yes, Han. Yeah. Pass it back.
Are you actually saying that we are source and it's about chipping off all the...
I understand, Haim, that's a good point. There's even a sutra of the Buddhas that seems to indicate we're already Buddhas, if you like, we just have to discover it. But the teachings would say, technically, that's not true. So let me talk about this a little bit, okay? you know, there's this... Okay, the Mahayana teachings would say, that this is a terminology they use in Buddhism, that all beings possess Buddha nature. So that's a bit abstract. We don't get what that means. And we can make up all sorts of interesting stories. And if you read this Sutra of the Buddhas, they say it's not a definitive sutra, it's an interpretive one, that you could exactly have that view. And many people, Zen people especially, say this. Many people who practice Dzogchen say this. There's different ways of talking in the different Buddhist teachings. That we're already Buddha, we just have to discover it, okay? Which I think, okay, never mind what I think, what I do think. But it's very tasty and it's very encouraging, because if we think we're such creeps, which the ego does, we all think we're miserable, we identify 100% with our misery. Do you see what I'm saying here? We think that's who we really are. So it can be very inspiring to think I'm kind of already a Buddha, I've just got to discover it. But technically, it's kind of ridiculous. It's not true. It can't be. It's bizarre, actually. Let me explain. I like to use the analogy of an acorn. I don't know, because it's a seed that's kind of a big fat seed, isn't it? And it's a seed. We know an acorn is a seed that produces an oak tree, isn't it? So on the face of it... Huh?
Potentially, not all acorns.
Well, yeah. Okay, wait. No, I disagree. If it is defined as an acorn, it is a potential oak tree. If it's a broken acorn, it's not an acorn. Okay. So if it's an acorn, it's a... So would we agree that all acorns are potential oak trees? Would you agree with that? So that means all acorns possess oak tree nature, don't they? So you can get the meaning now, can't you?
Yeah.
So it's okay. So if we think that we're all really Buddhas, we've got to discover it, then all acorns are really oak trees. Well, try getting shade from an acorn, okay? You'll be very disappointed. So technically it's not true, but my feeling is if for so long you've just thought an acorn was a boring old thing standing on the ground, and all around you are these beautiful oak trees, and you wish you had an oak tree, and then you're staring at it right there, but you didn't know. So it's very tasty to think, oh my God, there's an oak tree, almost like it's there to touch, you know? It's very encouraging for us to counteract ego's miserable view of self-pity. You see what I'm saying, Haim?
Yeah, but you're saying this is not true.
Haim, be a bit loosey-goosey about it. It's true. I am saying you're not a Buddha, yeah.
If no, the original question has been, are we all enlightened? And the only
that's what I'm saying. Did you hear my answer?
The answer has been that it's not strictly truth, even though it's very flattering at times to think about.
Not flattering, helpful, darling. It's helpful.
Yes.
Thank you. That's it, home. You did it.
So, what is it then, our nature?
Huh?
If we are all in potential Buddhas, but are not really according.
Not yet Buddha.
Ah.
That's the point. So it's a process. It's like if your mummy, like, you know, if she's a great musician and she sees a little Haim there, she can recognize the potential bark in Haim, can't she? She would be able to do that because she's a great musician, let's say. So she can really see you've got the potential to be bark. But how it's going to happen is you've got to learn how to be bark. You've got to play the piano and learn the theories. And so you will turn yourself into bark, won't you? Your own bark. Like that. You've got to do the work, you know? You see the point? It's a practical thing, like learning to be a musician, learning to make a cake. You've got to have the theories, you've got to have the potential, you apply the theories, and eventually you'll get the result. Buddha the same.
So we are enlightened.
Pardon? I'm so sorry, hon.
We have the potentiality for enlightenment, but what we need is to put the work in.
Yes, that's it exactly, darling.
Thank
you, hon. Yeah, who else? Please, where's the microphone?
Sorry.
Oh, okay. You have it. Go on.
I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly about karma affects our physical and geographical.
Yes, totally, utterly, completely. Yes. There's no other cause.
Yeah.
Let's talk more, shall we? You mean?
Yeah, a little bit, please. Yeah, be great.
See, this gets a bit complex, you know. I'll do my best. Okay. Okay. What time is it? We've got one more day, haven't we? Okay, so when you study the teachings in the beginning stages, they kind of, it's like you learn the simplest level of it, which is sort of the theories, you know? And it's only when you start looking into it in more depth that you can kind of join all the dots and understand the logic of it all, which just takes time, okay? So we'll do our best to see if we can try and describe, okay? Kind of interesting. If we take the Vajrayana ways of seeing the world, which is that, and this is not contrary to the other views as well. Okay, never mind that. Never forget Vajrayana. In general, there's a way of describing in Buddhism that the universe consists of two things: sentient beings, mind streams, consciousnesses, trillions upon trillions upon trillions. I've heard in the teachings, there's not an atom of space you won't find a sentient being. And then you have matter, and it's made of the four elements. We thought that back in our, you know, in our age, back then in the Middle Ages, didn't we, with Galileo and that mob. But now we've got all these other complicated contents of the universe, physics and everything, isn't it? But there's still the Buddha's view called the four elements. There's physical phenomena, and there are consciousnesses. So as His Holiness said one time in one of his many discussions with scientists, Big Bang, no problem. Just not the first Big Bang, that's all. So, you know, matter also for Buddha, the four elements, are beginningless also. They're not made by anybody. They don't come out of anywhere. They are also beginningless, which is a mad idea to us because we have this utter conviction there has to be a first moment. You know, why? God knows, but we do. Buddha would say it's because of this delusion, this ego grasping. So all matter, the four elements existing. So the question that has to be, what is the relationship between minds and the four elements, isn't it? That's your essential question, isn't it? Okay, this is where the Vajrayana explanations come in very interestingly. In that model, which by the way is the same model the Tibetan medical system uses to interpret your illnesses. So if you go to like I said before, the Vajrayana model has, we've got gross consciousness, which is the sensory and the conceptual, but it's inextricably linked to the physical. It's got its own, you know, this gross bone, this bag of bones here. So you wouldn't have the gross conceptual and the gross sensory without the body. Very clear. They're interdependent. They're separate individual phenomena. One lot is physical and one lot is not. They're distinct, but you can't separate, which is an interesting concept. Then you've got subtle consciousness, which happens every time you go to sleep, your gross level has ceased. You know, I'll tap you when you're really fast asleep. You won't feel it because you know, they've got this whole description of the mind in the Vajrayana model, how all the grosser level of consciousness have kind of absorbed. You know, there's a whole detailed description, which is also in the Tibetan medical system. Now you get to the subtle level. And it's the same at the time of death. When you stop breathing, when you're ready for the body bag in our culture, you're not dead yet as far as this model is concerned, you know. You've gone now to your subtle consciousness. And there's no physical evidence of it because it's not the gross physical. You've got subtle consciousness and then the subtle physical level that level of consciousness also is inextricably linked with, inseparably. Never mind all the details, just go into that. Then you go through the death process. You go all the way down to what they call, you know, you do deconstruct the grosser levels, subtler, to get to very subtle consciousness. And that is inextricably linked with the very subtle physical, which is subtle wind energy, of the four elements. And the way they describe the elements in detail, all four elements have components of the other elements, you know. And so this physical world we can see is made of the four elements. This body is part of the physical world, is it not, you know? But this piece of the four elements here happens to be conjoined with the consciousness, right? So the difference between this body dead and alive is the presence or not of Rabina's, in this case, Rabina's consciousness. So in the Vajrayana, which is very interesting, they say that all consciousnesses have their own, are linked inextricably to their own set of the four elements. Again, this is just the observation of these beings, you know? So therefore, there's this intimate relationship between the physical, the four elements, and minds, the external and these ones. So Lama Zopa said in the Kala Chakra Tantra, the word Tantra and the word Sutra have two uses. One is referring to a level of teachings, and the other is referring to a text in those level of teachings. So the Kala Chakra Tantra is a very extensive text. And this is highly technical stuff in Tantra, you know. And it's, Rinpoche said, in this text there are these detailed descriptions of the intimate relationship between the internal and external energies. Internal refers to mind or consciousness, and external refers to the four elements. Right? So he said it very roughly. He said, when the mind is negative, delusion, anger, ego, hurt, all the unhappy stuff of ours, because of this intimate relationship that it's got with the subtler physical energies, they talk about the subtle nervous system, they talk about the wind energy, the prana, this is a bit similar to yoga. They talk about this intimate relationship between all your states of mind and the different wind energies. So you go to your Tibetan doctor, the Chinese doctor too, she'll feel your pulses. She's feeling the winds. But there's all these different states of mind, it's all highly complex, are intimately linked to those different winds. So she'll feel this imbalance of particular wind energies that are related to anger. And that is due to negative karma from the past, that the tendency is the mind to be angry, which then causes you to continue the anger, which continues to pollute your wind energies, which in turn karmically causes you to be born into a sick body, a body that's conducive to illness, okay? So in turn, karmically over much time, and this is highly, enormously complex, and again, no one is running it, this is not punishment reward, it just happens naturally, that eventually in turn impacts upon the external elements. So then let's just say due to past killing, what's your name?
Justin.
Let's say due to past killing, okay, let's say you're born a human now, clearly you're a human, so that means the main karma at the time of your past death was virtuous karma. That threw you into Justin's mummy's human womb. But he's got some killing karma from the past that he hasn't finished. So in this life, he's got the residual result of killing manifesting in three other ways, the tendency to kill. Let's say you meet fishing for the first time, you think it's the most divine thing since sliced bread. You'll just spend your life fishing because it looks gorgeous to you. That's because you've got the karmic imprint to kill. You see the fishing, it awakens it, it triggers good feelings. Whatever triggers a good feeling, it must be good, so you keep killing fish. And you don't see the suffering. You understand. Look at the world. Most humans kill something. That will be the karmic result of one of the results of the past killing. The tendency to keep killing. Second, due to past killing, you've also got a very weak body. You get sick easily. You have allergy. No, you get sick easily, or you die young, or you get killed. Look at the world. Babies die. Healthy people die. People die, you know, that getting killed is one of the karmic results of having killed. You with me? So that's the second result, the experience similar to the cause. The third one, the environmental karmic result, is you get, sorry, the sickness one is more that. You've got elements. You know, you're born to a mummy who's got all these diseases, and you get the genes of that diseases. So you're born to that external condition. So you're sick, you have allergies, you can't go in the sun, you can't go in this, you can't eat peanuts. I mean, look at some people's illnesses. Where you live is disgusting, the water's polluted, the air's polluted. That's the karmic result environmentally of past killing that you share with all the other people in that environment. So there's nothing, the Buddha's view would be, there's nothing that exists that isn't first the result of actions of sentient beings. Sentient beings are the creators of the universe. And the elements aren't made by us, but they're impacted because they're connected to the mind. Can you hear me a bit?
Yeah.
That makes sense? It's a concept. It's, yeah. I mean, again, excuse me, it's quite different from what we think, isn't it? This is Buddha's view.
Thank you.
So we're the boss. We make it, you know. And that's why one of the most profound teachings, everyday way to practice. You know, we sort of don't mind taking responsibility for what's in here. We can kind of begin to do that one. That's okay. We can kind of bear that. But when Serena comes and punches me in the nose, excuse me, that's not my fault, that's hers, definitely, you know. Or if you've got allergies, no one would say that's due to your past negative karma. Or equally, that you've got, you know, like your Warren Buffett, okay? Warren Buffett is 87, you know that mega-rich fellow? This mega-rich businessman who's very famous for being kind of easygoing. He still drives his old 1990s Toyota or something, even though he gave his $54 billion to Bill Gates for his foundation. He's still keeping doing business. He's unbelievable. He's 87. And his daughter said, I read his biography, his daughter said she has never seen water pass his lips. He lives on cheeseburgers, Coca-Cola and ice cream, and he's as fit as a fiddle. Now, this should destroy all scientific findings about health, but scientists don't want to know about that because the Buddha would say he's got such virtuous morality karma, the reverse of killing karma, that he's got a healthy body that's so healthy that whatever he eats nourishes him. Are you seeing what I'm saying? This is the Buddha's view. So it's not just the food you eat. We all know healthy people die, you know. Young people die. So we just go, oh, well, there's no medical cause. No one knows why. We put it in the too hard box. Do you see what I'm saying here? Okay. So the real tasty one I'm getting at is, as the way Lama Zopa says it, everything we experience is our own karmic appearance. Mean Serenas or beautiful Serenas. Beautiful environment, ugly environment, war zone, terrorism, pedophiles, whatever you see out there, you created the cause to even hear the word. Some people have never on this earth heard the word pedophile and they will die without hearing it. That's due to their virtuous karma. We don't even hear the concept of a pedophile. It's not an accident, you know. Everything you see and hear and experience, your karmic appearance. That means everything, that a powerful teaching there is, you know, I created that. Rather than look at those people out there, those ugly, how dare they do that to me or everybody else. You're separate from the world. There's a powerful way to break down this sense of separateness. It's a powerful way to help you understand emptiness. It's a powerful way to own responsibility for whatever you see and experience. It's really tasty, you know. But of course, it's hard to remember. Because we feel like this little separate, poor little, you know, victim plonked on this earth by someone else, like we're the handiwork of someone else, don't quite know what's going on around here. That's how we feel, isn't it? Not for the Buddha. Are we communicating, Peter?
Yep.
Yeah. Microphone, please. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just going to hold it. I can't stand all this noise and rubbish. Yeah. Okay.
So ideally it would be to accept our karma. But let's say we're in a situation...
bit close to the mic, sweetheart.
Let's say you're in a situation like a job with an abusive boss or yes. something like that. Mm. We don't have to endure that. We don't have to stay there if we don't.
No, you don't. Of course you don't.
I can get my stuff and leave.
That would be passivity. It would be pathetic. It would be worse than victim, wouldn't it?
Right.
But depends on your level. So you could say junior school level of practice... Okay, let's go into this more. Junior school level of practice is all about you. It's not about compassion yet. It's you protecting yourself at all costs from creating more negative karma and thus creating more suffering for yourself. It's all about you being cautious. And the main level of morality here is called the morality of restraint. So you refrain from harming, you refrain from killing, lying, stealing, you know, you understand. It's for your benefit. Mostly for your benefit because you don't want to create more negative karma because you stick a suffering, right? So this is where you really harness your energy. So if the situation from this level, where we're quite fragile really at this first level, you know, you then if this job is too difficult for you and you can't cope, you know he's got a problem, but you can't cope with the abuse because you're not strong enough in yourself, then of course it's best to leave. But the tragedy is, at that level, we're also victims, and victims can't act. Victims just want to blame. This is the tragedy of being a victim. So it's quite difficult. It's a very courageous thing to do, to up and leave the relationship, to up and leave the job, you know, because victims also like to blame. So it's quite difficult. But that would be the better practice. Now, if you're more advanced, it'll be your practice. It'll be grist for your mill, because it'll help you practice humility and patience and generosity, but you've got to be really together to do that. That's a very advanced level. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand. So if I can't do it joyfully...
Pardon?
If I can't do it joyfully... If
do
I
what?
Can't, well, stay there and accept that it's my karma and use it as my practice, then I have the right to leave. But with an understanding that this could possibly happen the next place I go, because if it's my karma, then the next place...
Yeah, but you don't be fundamentalist like that. You just be reasonable.
You see that...
But you be reasonable. You don't get too intellectual about it. That's silly.
No, I agree with you, but
well,
this is what I'm
problem?
Getting from other people, telling
well,
me,
tell them,
this is your karma.
Excuse me.
You have to deal with it.
That's total fundamentalist garbage.
I agree with
well,
you.
Well, then what are you telling me for, then, if you agree?
But I'm trying to get your point of view.
But you said you agree, so you know it already.
Yeah, okay.
So what
yeah.
are you asking?
I don't know. Your approval. Please approve.
So keep the microphone.
No.
Yes.
No.
Come on, you wimp.
Okay. All right, let's
you
go.
Tommy wimp. Darling, I'm not really fearful. I'm a very nice girl, okay?
I know.
One of my friends in prison, he's on that DVD out there. He when I told him I swear sometimes, he said, Rabina, you don't. You're a nice little old lady. Which is technically true. I'm a little old lady. Now, darling, listen to me, okay? Okay, listen. Given that whatever we experience is the fruit of our own past actions, we can only deal with it according to our capacity, can't we? So at the first level, we're being very tentative. We're being kind of trying to control, trying to harness, trying not to harm, lie, kill, steal. But you know, at that level, we're quite fragile if you can't do more advanced. So then you do what you can, you know? If you really can't bear that relationship with that abusive partner, then... But it's so hard. This is the irony. When we're also a little scaredy baby at that level, the ideal would be to up and leave. But... because we're such a victim, we don't think we can leave. We feel paralyzed. Look at most terrible relationships that people have. Living like hell on earth with this horrible partner they can't stand, the job they can't stand, because they don't have enough courage to leave, you know? So it's like it's paralysis. So the one of karma, though, this is the point, okay, the first level is about internalizing the view of karma. Forget compassion yet. We're not discussing compassion. We're going nowhere near like that. We're not even discussing using it as transforming problems into happiness, the more advanced level that we hear about, right? We're trying to recognize that this is, due to my past actions, I've got an ugly boss, okay? So then by thinking about karma, really trying to internalize it, already that is quite profound if you do it properly. Already it becomes a tool that lessens your ego grasping, that lessens the victim and lessens the fear because you know you created. And that will give you more courage and will give you more strength. And then, of course, you will be able to leave because you know it's your choice. If you can bear a situation, you stay there. If you can't, you leave. It's very reasonable. Mm-hmm. It's absurd and bizarre to think because you... It's sort of like thinking you've grown the weeds in there. That's due to you growing. Or you've got to let it grow now because you grew it. Mm. You can pull a weed out anytime you like. And that's the business about purification, which we want to get to soon. When we add this into the mix, in this first level of practice in junior school, the very first level is, entry level is, stop harming others. And I'm going to go into detail on this one. Why? Because it's going to harm you, and I'll explain. But the next little piece is, you then do that in the context of vows, which gives great, like a rocket boost. And then the next one is, that's where purification comes in, you know? Where we have this, so you stop creating more, you stop sowing more weeds, but you've got an awful lot of weeds in the past, you've sown a lot of weeds in the past, and you don't want them to grow, so you want to pull them out before they grow. That's purification. So we do that every day. That can even help change the situation, actually. Quite powerful. We'll go into that.
Thanks.
I keep promising, but we will. So any more questions before I go into... I want to go into more depth about morality. Time, no more questions. Not from you. You just have to sit and listen. Oh, all right. Come on then. Quickly. Say it, Haim. What is it? You have to give him the microphone, please. Pass the microphone back to Haim.
Thank you. In one of the teachings or in one of the Buddhist interpretation or Buddha's interpretations, yes. There's a description of the house of samsara.
The what of samsara?
Description.
Of?
The house of samsara.
What's that word of samsara, the first word? Who?
House.
Spell it.
House, home, house.
Oh, okay, the house. Okay, sorry, go
okay.
on.
Okay. Now, I'd like to have your view on taking that into account.
I don't know what it means, darling. Explain it.
Oh, okay, that there's God, godlike, humans, animals.
Oh, you mean the different realms of existence? The realms of the different types of rebirth?
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
So then, okay. Within that context, I'd like you to explain what's your version of the population explosion on the planet. Okay, does it mean we are getting enlightened?
No, I understand, darling. Okay. No, it doesn't. Just briefly there. Okay, the Buddha's view is that we're in a really degenerate time and we're going down fast. So from that perspective, there's more easy to get a human birth because the human birth is worth less now. It's getting more and more garbage, you know, more and more delusion, more and more violence, more and more pollution. So it's easier to get a human birth from the other realms, but it's still better, but it's not such a high rebirth anymore. That's all, that's the main thing. So, okay. I want to now talk. Yes, sweetheart. Give her the microphone, please. Yes.
You said that attachment is one of the main causes of suffering.
Yeah. But we haven't begun to go into it yet.
but newborn babies need to become securely attached to survive.
But so this is a different definition, sweetheart. Like I said about flat. Different definition. And I haven't begun really to go into the states of mind yet, and I will.
Right.
I keep promising, but time is running out. We need a week or something here. I understand exactly. We'll go into this. But I want to first here go into, if we talk about the first level of practice, which is the solution, you know, we looked at the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. Okay, good. We looked at the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. The first kind of suffering, as we described, is called the suffering of suffering, which is when the bad things happen to us. So then we have to ask, what's the causes of that? We go to the second noble truth. Well, Buddha, like we've said, narrows it down to two things, karma and delusions. And they both subsume down into the one. Delusions are the main cause. So karma is what we do on the basis of those delusions. But if we want to look at the first noble truth, we want to know what are the causes of that in particular. So the cause of bad things happening to us is our having done bad things in the future. It's quite simple in that sense. So then we ask, well, what's the solution to that level of suffering? Just that level of suffering. This is another way of presenting Buddha's teachings. The fourth noble truth is normally presented as the eightfold path, the methods we use. But I'm just presenting it slightly differently here. If we take the first kind of suffering, which is when the bad things happen, meany people, lying, stealing from you, sickness, all this, right? With this suffering, we know backwards. So if you want, well, what's the cause of this? Okay, let's the second noble truth, karma, delusions. Well, what kind of karma? What would I have done in the past to cause this? Well, you must have harmed others. Like I said about killing, there are four results of all actions. One is the fully ripened result, the type of rebirth. We didn't get that one. We got the human birth. But we can all see in this life, we've got certain tendencies that are negative from having done them before. We've got certain experiences that happens to us because we did it before, and even the environmental. So then we think, okay, the cause of bad things happening. If people lie to me all the time, I must have lied in the past. If people kill me, well, you know, we can't do much then. But if people try to kill me or, you know, they beat me up or something, I must have done that in the past. It's not really rocket science. So then you go, well, what's the solution? You go to the fourth noble truth. You think, well, okay, what's the solution to this? Well, taking this Tibetan packaging, they call it the Lam Rim. Okay, you must know that term. Path gradual. But it's 14th century, okay, Mr. Tsongkhapa. We would translate that as a course. It's gradual. You go gradually. So the very, like I said, entry level, junior school practice, this is junior school practice, which essentially is abiding by the laws of karma, refraining from harming others. That one alone, just junior school, not learning to be your own therapist yet, not even learning to meditate yet, that's high school, and that deals with a subtler level of suffering. But this one, merely refraining from killing, lying, stealing, this one, that one, three of your body and four of your speech. Beginning to work on your mind, but mainly body and speech. That's the solution to stop the first kind of suffering. It's practical. So if you don't want to be punched in the nose, killed, lied to, jumped on by wrong people, not to mention the rest of it, then stop causing it, sweetie pies. This is Buddha's solution. It's not complicated. Be a nice person. Behave nicely. Even do it in the context of vows. So I'll explain this now. So we're looking at the very first level of practice, which is the solution to stop the first kind of suffering. Are we communicating here? Okay, good. So let's look at the first level of practice, which is simply Buddha saying, abide by the laws of karma, means abide by the laws of morality. So now we have to ask, well, what's morality? Now, this, I think, is a very interesting discussion. We don't usually unpack this. Let's unpack it. And if we're Buddhist, it's extremely important we get Buddha's take on it. So, okay, if I'm a Catholic, and I was, and I remember I have a Jesuit priest friend, and I asked him many years ago, and I find this so helpful, I said, what is a sin by definition? He said, it is when you go against the will of God. Now, that makes perfect sense if you have the view of a creator. It's correct because the creator is the boss. He calls the shots. He made me. He made the laws of morality. So then naturally, of course, he is to be obeyed. It's completely reasonable from that perspective. And now but now look at this. Look at our materialist view. It's very similar. It's a dualistic view of morality because we somehow vaguely think of it, even if we're not religious, it's sort of morality is coming from up here somewhere where a bunch of people are imposing upon me a set of rules. That's why we resist it so mightily. And you listen to this. I'm in my mummy's house, and she says, don't do that. Well, being a smarty pants, I will say, why not? Now, we know her answer will be, because I say so. Now, this is, I think, instinctively, our view of morality. So that's why we resist. That's why when I do what mummy said, mummy, I did what you said, and I want her to praise me. And if she doesn't see me and I do it, I'll think, great, I got away with it. Would you agree that's our view of morality on this earth? We're instinctively this way. We instinctively try to hide our bad things and we want to be seen to be good. This is deluded. Buddha says this fits with this deluded view of the ego and how it works. Now, Buddha's view of morality, he says it's got nothing to do with what a person says. It's a natural law. So he says, do your market research in this room. You're going to find very quickly there'll be 100% agreement. No one likes being killed, jumped on if they don't belong to them, you know, or having their partner jumped on, or stolen from. Three of the body. And we don't like the four of the speech. We don't like being lied to. We don't like being abused verbally. We don't like having people talk about us behind their back when it's naughty and when it's horrible, it's so painful. And we don't like having people just rabbit on in front of us, you know, go blah, blah, whether we want to hear it or not. We know this immediately. Every one of us in this room will agree we don't like that. It hurts us. So Buddha's view is what immorality is an action that harms another. And he gets it down to seven little baby points. Seven little tiny little bullet points. Seven little, a little checklist of seven don'ts. Not like complicated, like driving a car. It's got millions of points to remember. You've got to pass your test. You'd have to have so many things to remember. This is seven little things. Buddha says, Rabina, don't kill. Don't cheat on your partner. Don't steal, don't lie, don't rabbit on about nothing, don't harsh speech, and don't talk about people behind their backs. It's not complicated. And why wouldn't I do that, Buddha? Because, Rabina, darling, that's what harms others, but why you wouldn't do it, and this is the point here, is because, Rabina, it'll harm you, sweetheart. Now, that's not evident to us. We don't think this now, so let's look at Buddha's logic for why my killing harms me. Why my lying harms me. It's really important to unpack it logically. Not just believe it as somebody's view, you know. This is an incredibly important point, actually. So, okay, why will my killing someone else harm me? Why will my lying harm me? Why will my harming others harm me? Don't just believe it. Let's analyze it carefully, okay? This is in your notes. All this is in your notes. In the section called the 10 non-virtues. Okay, let's look. Let's, you know, in order for any action we do to be what they call a complete action, which means a seed that's planted in the mind that you don't pull out that will eventually ripen as many types of rebirth. because seeds bring many fruits. So an action of killing, for example, if left in the mind and not pulled out, will ripen as many suffering types of rebirth, like animals or something like that, Buddha would say. Okay, so let's look at this. Let's analyze it. So not just that. As I said before, all actions can have all four results. One is the type of rebirth. One is the tendency to keep doing it. One is the experience of having it done to you. And one is the environmental result. All virtuous karmas and all non-virtuous karmas, period, have these results. All these actions are the creators of our universes, including for the Buddha, hell realms, spirit realms, God realms. There's many types of rebirth. They're all states of mind created by those sentient beings. They're all their karmic appearances coming along with a certain level of physicality. It's a natural law, Buddha says. No one makes it this way. No one punishes. No one rewards. Okay, so let's look at the action of killing. Let's break it down, because it too is a dependent arising. It too is empty of inherent existence. It too doesn't exist from its own side. It's a dependent arising. So let's look at the components of a complete action of killing. So in order for an action of killing, say that mouse in my kitchen, in order for that to be a complete action, there have to be four things in place. The first one is there needs to be the object, a living mouse. Number two has three parts, 2A, B, and C. We can generally refer to the second point as intention. Now, it's got 2A is you have to have a state of mind in here. It's called recognition, like I said before. It's the part of our mind that's functioning all the time that can distinguish between this and that, and it's working all the time that makes us reasonable in whatever we're doing, including negative actions. If you think that's Fred, but really that's Fred, then you'll kill the wrong person. You'll be in trouble as a sniper. You've got to have this good recognition. So recognition, the first one, 2A, is the recognition that that is the living mouse I'm about to kill. 2B is actually intention, which is the simple thought, I will kill that mouse. But the crucial piece in this whole scenario is what we'd call the reason you will kill the mouse. So let's face it, most of us on this earth, the reason most of us kill, there's either anger, aversion for the mouse is like disgust, or it's attachment. That's why people kill mice, kill fish. Fishermen love fish, but they want to kill them because, you know, whatever the reason, they're attached to that habit. But it's not out of the motivation that propels that action is not anger, it's attachment. So in this case, you know, unless of course I want to eat mouse for lunch, you know, look at the difference. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Let's say I'm attached to mice flesh for lunch. Oh, there's a mouse. Oh, my God, be careful. Don't hurt it. Kill it nicely. And I'm all happy and smiling to find a mouse, aren't I? A mouse. Then I'll kill it nicely so I don't ruin the flesh, you know, so I have a delicious fried mouse for lunch. Do you see my point here? But obviously it's not that. It's usually, oh, disgusting. How dare a mouse be in my kitchen? Which is called aversion. It's the bare-bones state behind anger. Okay? That's the usual reason most people kill mouse. Would you agree? Would you agree with me, people? The delusion. Okay, there's the delusion. So two, one is the object. Two is the recognition that's that mouse. 2A, 2B is intention. I will kill the mouse. But that's the meaning of karma. Intention equals karma, okay? But the motivation that impels you to fulfill that intention, that's the crucial major piece that is what turns it into a negative action when you do it, that causes you to sow a negative seed in your mind. The third one is you do the action. The fourth one is the mouse dies before you. That's a complete action. And if you leave that seed in your mind, it'll multiply and multiply and eventually ripen as many suffering rebirths, Buddha says. And then not to mention the other residual results, you know, the habit and those. So, okay, just to show, so the point in here is, all of those are together. All those are components of a negative action of killing a mouse. But you can break it down and you could say the crucial piece in there that is what makes it negative when you do it is the motivation, is the anger. So look at the difference, say, in a person. Let's say, what's his name down the end again? Radhik. Okay, no, you can write your notes, it's okay. Radhik. Let's say Radhik has a mouse in his kitchen. And there can be debates about this one. Shh. There's the object. Second, number two, recognition. There's the mouse I'm going to kill. Two, B, there's the intention. I will kill the mouse. But look at 2C. He has compassion. He's mistaken in thinking that killing a mouse will help the mouse. And I'll talk about this in a second, why it isn't necessarily useful. But he really has compassion. He really thinks, if I kill the mouse, I'll stop it suffering, because he sees the poor little mouse is suffering. We have this. This is called euthanasia. Whether it's your grandma or a mouse, we have this one, don't we? So we can see instantaneously, can't we? It can't be the same action. When you look at Rabina, her face is full of distorted anger and wants to smash this wretched creature. When you see him, he's full of compassion, isn't he? So, okay, the Hinayana teachings, the Theravadan teachings, and the Mahayana would interpret this slightly differently. But in general, the Mahayana would say, if he has such compassion, then you almost could argue he doesn't create negative karma, because it's what's in the mind. It's the virtue or the non-virtue in the mind that is the main component in the karma we create. This would certainly be the Mahayana view. Can you hear this? If you looked at both of us, you'd see him looking with loving and compassion to this little mouse. You look at me, you see this ugly look on my face. So what is our mind imbued with? In my case, anger. In his case, compassion, isn't it? So even if he does kill the mouse, and the poor mouse goes from the frying pan into the fire, because he's not clairvoyant, and it takes a hell birth, nevertheless, you could say this compassion redeems his action. So I'm not suggesting you run around killing with compassion, but I'm trying to point out the crucial role of that component in an action we do. And that's why most actions we do they're motivated by attachment or aversion. Most of our actions of most sentient beings, there is the goodness there. There's masses of goodness. I'm not discussing that yet. We're trying to identify the polluted part of our mind so we can remove them, okay? So our compassion be limitless. You see what I'm saying here? So you could argue that he's got compassion there, but he's got this attachment. Because when we've got compassion, we have lots of attachment. And because attachment only wants what it wants. So actually the attachment pollutes his compassion. Because he can't bear the thought of the suffering mouse because he doesn't like it. And that's often what makes us do things to help others. It's really for our sake, half the time. Because we don't have the wisdom to know if it really will help the mouse. We just want it to all go away. Do you understand? So it's a bit tricky for the mind. But nevertheless, you can see the stark difference between my action and his. The one piece that's different. The first one, same. 2A, that mouse, same. Intention, same. Motivation, different. Action, same. Result, same. One small component has changed. And that's the main one that determines whether what I do is negative or positive. Can you hear this? Can you hear this? This is especially the Mahayana. Which is why in the Mahayana teachings, which we'll talk more about tomorrow, the actions we normally do of eating and sleeping and going to the toilet and having sex and drugs and rock and roll, which in their nature are propelled by attachment, they're just junk, they're the actions of a junkie with respect, they're just going to create more suffering. So that the Mahayana one is, before you shove the food in the mouth, you have a few virtuous thoughts. You change your motivation. And that can help redeem, lessen the attachment. Best to give up attachment, of course. But there's a way, you know. There's other methods of practicing. We'll discuss this more tomorrow. Are we communicating here? So this is therefore the view of morality in Buddhism is a totally natural law. It's got nothing to do with Buddha saying it. So Buddha sounds like Jesus. He says don't kill, but the difference is, the reason is very different. Jesus is because God said, Buddha because he's more like a doctor. So I go to my doctor and she'll say, Rabina, you better not smoke, darling, you might get cancer. Well, I'm not going to be insulted, am I? Who do you think you are telling me what to do? I won't say that. I'll be totally grateful to the doctor, won't I? Because I know she's giving me advice from her experience. So then when I go home, imagine how stupid I'd be if I go, well, she doesn't see me smoke, I won't get cancer. That's our view of morality now. But we know we don't have that when it comes to food and health, because we understand the simple law of karma, which is that whatever I do brings consequences to me. We've got that down when it comes to food, but we don't have that down at all when it comes to virtue and non-virtue. We just think it's some imposed set of rules by some silly, boring, mindful person. You kind of see what I'm saying a bit? So we've got to grow up, you know. Buddha says it's a natural law. Nothing to do with punishment, reward. No one's running the show here. No one's, you know, whether you hide away, there's no such thing as getting away with something. It's a beyond bizarre idea. If karma's a natural law, there's no such thing as getting away, you know. because you harm yourself and you benefit yourself. That's why this junior school level already is profound. It really is you growing up, becoming accountable, realizing you're in charge, you created your own reality, you created your life, and you're going to damn well change it, you know, rather than being the victim. This takes time. It's intense. But this is Buddha's view, you know. This is junior school. Oh, my God. Are we communicating? Okay. Yes. Microphone, please.
The mouse in a past life has been a bad mouse, yeah?
What, darling?
The mouse in its past life has been bad or...
If it's been killed, yes, it's a result of its own past action, yeah.
So
that's right.
If... Compassion, I can't remember your name, sorry. Compassion over here kills the mouse because he sees that it's hurt.
That's right.
Does that mouse have to come back and die again?
No, it's nothing to do with the mouse. This is okay.
If it's karma hasn't ripened because it's been killed out of compassion, even though it was supposed to...
No, this is... Okay, I understand your question. No, there's two things going on here, okay? One is we have to look at the mouse and its karma, and the other one we're looking at Radik's karma. They're two separate things, completely separate. His killing with compassion... Look, listen, with him in my case, there are two dead mice, right? They couldn't care less whether I kill with anger or not. They're both dead. Their karma ripened, you know, at the hand of me or at the hand of him. Right. So there's two things. One is I'm looking at the karma he and I create. We're not looking at the mouse yet at all. We're looking at the karma we create. And I've looked at particularly the breaking down into the component parts of what is a negative action, what does make it negative, what are the components there. That's what we're doing. That's what we're doing here. Yeah. Now we could look, let's look at, if we can, the karma of the mice, and that's another discussion. You could even say this. Let's say I'm this monster who hates mice. You know, I hate mice, and I'm evil. I can't stand them. I want to torture the wretched creatures. But let's say I've got a Buddhist next-door neighbour who's playing mantras while I slaughter my mouse. Well, my little mouse, hearing the mantras, it puts a little imprint in its mind and it triggers its karmic imprint to be born as a human being and become a Buddhist next life. Well, lucky mouse. But I don't get any benefit from that because my delusion ran my show. But little lucky mouse, other conditions ripen for that little mouse that had got a Buddhist rebirth. But his little mouse, which he wants to help, he's full of love and compassion. But his poor little mouse is suffering so terribly already. His poor little ego is having a panic attack and he comes along and starts killing it. I mean, the poor thing will increase his fear and panic and that will cause negative karma to ripen and his poor little mouse will fall into the hell realms. So this has got nothing to do with whether the mice benefit. This is two discussions here. You get my point?
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Good. So the point here is this. Yeah. You know, as His Holiness often says, compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. So clearly, in our ordinary daily life, compassion is the one we're interacting with others. This is the crucial one. We're going to talk about this tomorrow, you know. So... But compassion, I indicated this before, if we haven't worked much on our minds and haven't understood our own delusions, then all these delusions come along like a big soup along with the compassion and they pollute our compassion, they drag it down. And we can't see the difference between the attachment to getting what I want and my fear of seeing a suffering mouse and understanding what's really best for that mouse. That is a bit tough one for us. So what would be the, you know, even in just helping your alcoholic brother, you know, remember attachment, I haven't even gone into it yet, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time, I'm so sorry, I can't help it. But, you know, it's tea time. Hang on.
Oh, no.
10 more minutes. Okay. Attachment, which we'll talk about, is this, like I said, this junkie, this desperate, frantic, fear-based junkie that's there every millisecond underlying everything that frantically, desperately only wants the nice things. It can't be anything but the nice things. Have a look at us. You even drop something, you get upset. Upset is a polite word for anger. Why? Because attachment wants the nice things. Attachment wants the smooth, the lovely, the sweet, the delicious, the pleasant. It can only cope with the nice things. The stronger our attachment, and it's in every single being, I tell you, it runs the show, then the more frantic when it doesn't get what it wants. So you've got lots of attachment, but lots of compassion too. Then you don't have to be an angry person. But your attachment is so desperate to have everything lovely, you can't bear to see the suffering world. This is why some people get so depressed, because they can't look at the suffering world. It's unbearable, because you don't know what to do about it, which is a really good point. So certain people, like me, will get out there and shout and yell and become a political activist, you know, shouting and yelling and trying to bash the world into shape. But other people, more depressed, will go inside and become despairing because they can't bear to see the suffering. That's because of attachment. So when you give up attachment, you become fearless. You can see the garbage. You know why it's there. You've got the view of karma. You understand why the mouse is dying. You understand why there's war here and Syria there and this and that. So that gives you, that kind of imbues your compassion with a lot of wisdom and strength. So you don't panic when bad things happen. So then you'll be able to be more rational about the mouse. And of course, having the view of karma, you will know you're not clairvoyant. You can't see the karma of that mouse. You have got no idea what birth it will take when you kill it. So you wouldn't dare intervene your ego into it. You'll do everything you can to help the mouse by die peacefully. To die peacefully is a great, incredible gift to a being. You make the mouse safe. You put a little mantra on. You make it peaceful. You calm its little mind down. And you allow, you know, it's hearing the Buddha's mantras, it calms its mind, you know, so it's not feeling panic-stricken, which is ego, so then it'll die peacefully, and it'll purify its karma meanwhile. Much better, if we can. Much better. So don't, you know, run around killing grandma or your cat, you know. Let it work out its own karma, but you support it and love it and nurture it and help it be peaceful. That's a big thing at the time of death. People need to have someone to rely upon to help them be peaceful. This book I'm working on at the moment, just finished, it's getting designed, ready for download, FPMT, for free, right? It's called Lama Zopa's Teachings on How to Help in the Time of Death. It's called, from Lama Zopa's words, How to Help Your Loved Ones Enjoy Death and Go Happily to Their Next Rebirth, okay? And so there's an instruction manual of what to do, how to help people, okay, including the animals. So one of the most precious times, as Rinpoche says, to help people is at the time of death. That's this hugely important time when the karmic seed will ripen from the billions of karmic seeds we're lugging around in our mind that will determine our next birth, you know. It's hugely important time for the mouse, for grandma, for everybody. The most precious time to help is then, especially when they're close to death, you know, because that's when the karmic seed ripens. And when the mind is peaceful and virtuous, it triggers a virtuous seed to ripen. When the mind is panic-stricken, which is related to ego, a negative seed ripens. It's just a technical point. So it's hugely important to help them in the time of death, you know. That would be the most compassionate action. Okay. So, there's more about karma and more about the mind going back and forth, okay, how the delusions work. So now, remember the first level of suffering, the suffering of suffering. It's when the bad things happen. So then you check, what are the causes of this? You go to the second noble truth, karma and delusions. Well, which karma would it have been? Well, if people punch me in the nose, I must have punched. If they lie to me, I must have lied. If they kill me, I must have killed them. Whatever it might be, thinking simply, okay? So the solution, fourth noble truth, go to here, junior school, in this particular packaging, refrain from harming others. This is why the Buddha would say, an action is negative, is one that harms another, but when you do it because it's motivated by delusion, that's what makes it harm you, because it leaves an imprint in your mind. Because everything we think and do and say is stored in your consciousness. It's like one lama said, I think it was Geshe Tashi here actually, everything we see and hear and experience through our senses and do and think, it's like we're taking photos, millions of photos in a day, and we're storing them in our memory, not your brain, your mind. And then that's what plays out next life. You know, you make a movie and then you play the movie out next life. We create our own realities, Buddha's saying. This is what's so shocking about Buddha, so amazing, so delicious, actually. We create our own experiences, you know. So suffering, I'm sick of it, and you've got to have this one. Don't get all holy and think, oh, that just sounds too selfish. Excuse me. The first path is all about having the intelligence, the self-respect, of being sick of suffering, realizing you have caused it, and I'm going to grow up here and start taking responsibility, so I'm going to start changing. This is so powerful. This is junior school. So you abide by the laws of morality. You don't kill, lie, steal, the first seven of body and speech. You begin, still in junior school, you just begin to work on your mind. So there's the three more that make up the 10 non-virtues, as they call it. And these three are of the mind. And my way of putting this is just the beginnings of working on your mind. He calls the first one the three main delusions. In this package of these delusions, there's the root delusion, then there's attachment, and then there's aversion. So the general day-to-day level of ignorance, the first one, is like this huge kind of narrow-minded, very fundamentalist, racist, sexist, narrow-mindedness, which is very much based in fear. Then the other delusion is attachment, then the other one is aversion, anger. So the three main kind of grosser levels of these three to begin in this first 10 to start avoiding still junior school, the emphasis is body and speech, but this is the mind. You try to at least lessen craving, the extreme level of attachment, which means subdue your senses to some extent. And keep remembering, it's not because someone said, it's not because sex is bad, it's not because food is bad, it's not because you're naughty, all these childish views we have of morality, it's because, baby, it'll harm you. Got to hear this. So how does attachment harm me? Because attachment is like being a junkie. Everybody can see with half a brain that if you're attached to something like alcohol or heroin, excuse me, it harms you, sweetheart. Well, all attachment. It's just a question of degree and it's a question of the object when it's attachment. But this is the point. It's incredibly hard to see. It's incredibly hard to distinguish. So let's now go into attachment. And this lady back there, her point. Okay, just to say it, in this first level of practice, junior school, in this packaging, the Tibetan packaging, the first 10 non-virtues that you use as your general guideline, and this is also the answer to where do you start, Ian? What happened to Ian? There he is. You take these 10. The first is your body and speech, and the last three, you begin to observe you know, the grossest level of our attachment, which is for the objects of the senses. Then we begin to look at the grosser level of anger, which is like ill will. You can't let go. Look at the world and the intensity of the suffering of anger that you can't let go of it. Some people murder, they go in the most terrible things. This is like a nightmare of anger. It's bad enough being angry, but if you let go of it, that's a miracle. You don't hold on, you don't hold a grudge, you know. This is the worst part of anger. You hold a grudge and you want the other people to suffer. You go mad and you'll end up killing, no question. Try and let go of that one. And the grossest level of ignorance is this real narrow-minded, fundamentalist, black and white, you, me, how dare, I'm right, you're wrong. This really terrifying state of incredible, deluded ignorance. So just beginning to harness our energy at this level, these 10, miraculous, miraculous level of practice, miraculous practice. This is just junior school. Then you can enhance this by consciously taking refuge, becoming a Buddhist, and then taking your vows. And the vows usually in this tradition, it's the first level of vows related to this level of practice, which is the level of morality of restraint. You take 5 vows. The 10 are your guideline, but they're put into these vows, this set of vows of Lord Buddha. You kind of plug into this power source, taking them from a person who is the Buddha for you, who tracks right back in an unbroken lineage right back to the Buddha. And Buddha puts enormous emphasis on vows. They say in the teachings that anyone who lives in vows, Buddha say this, which is a formal thing you do on your knee in front of somebody whom you see as representing the Buddha for you, and you vow never to kill till the day you die. You vow never to lie, never to cheat on a partner or take someone else's partner, and vow never to take alcohol or other intoxicants and not steal. You can take any or all of these. You don't have to take them all. So the vow, Buddha says, is like it's like a subtle energy that clairvoyance can see. It's something so potent about committing your life to be a moral person. It's amazing, actually. Incredible. And then every day you keep these vows, and then every day you also purify weakened and broken vows with the purification practice, which we're getting to. But also the marvelous thing is this. Okay, this is a technical point. If intention is the meaning of karma, then you create... Okay, a third example of killing, okay? What's your name? Natasha, let's say Natasha has a mouse in her kitchen, but she doesn't even see it. So the first point, number one, there is a mouse, that's there. The second point, 1A, recognizing that's the mouse, she doesn't have that, she doesn't see it. Therefore, there can't be 2B, which is intention. Therefore, there can't be 2C, which is motivation. So 2 is missing altogether. You hear me? The 3, she kills the mouse, a foot goes on it. And 4, the mouse dies. So, but 2 is missing. So you could argue there is no karma because karma means intention. Karma is the mind engaging, propelled by a motivation to do an action. It's highly dynamic. It's highly psychological. It's not fundamentalist or religious. So you could argue she doesn't even create karma. She doesn't even see a mouse. Now, much of our actions are like this. Of course, it doesn't mean you walk around not caring, because the more aware you become, the more mindful you become, the more conscious you become, you'll avoid harming sentient beings. Because you wake up more, you know. But just strictly speaking, looking at the way we create karma, you could argue that one. So living in vows is very powerful. So as Lama Zopa says this, here we, you know, look, okay, to do an action of, say, to do an action of killing in my case, I have to intend to kill, plus the motivation of anger, that makes it a negative action for me. So her action, there being no intention, there is no karmic result. You can argue this. You could argue, because there's no mind engaging in it, because mind is the point. Mind is what creates karma first. So now, therefore, you could argue in reverse. Here we are trying to be good people and have the intentional decision, I will not kill, I will not steal, I will not lie, which is this first level of practice. So we are sitting in this room right now, let's say, and we probably don't have an intention, I will not kill. Do we, at this moment, simply because there's no mouse in front of us to avoid killing, or there's no mosquito eating you? It's only when you meet a sentient being that you say, I will not kill. Isn't this true? So therefore, we are creating zero virtue of non-killing. And just to get a human body in karmic life, you know, sorry, to get a reborn in a human body, you need bucket loads of very powerful, conscious, intentional karmic seeds of non-killing. Can you hear this? Are you hearing me, people? Thank you very much. So therefore, just being a nice person, as Lama Zopa says, is not enough. You've got to have an intention not to kill, which is one of the most powerful seeds we need to create. The simple way to do that is if, the Buddha says, if you live in a vow not to kill, then he says the vow is so potent that there's subtle physical energy, first of all, and second, every second you're keeping that vow, even when you're asleep, even when you're in the pub drinking your beer, assuming you don't have an alcohol vow. Well, no, that would even, you break that vow instead. You know, even you're having fun with your new girlfriend. Every second, 24 hours a day, you're keeping that vow, you're ticking over powerful, virtuous karmic seeds and purifying your mind. So, in fact, in the teachings it says, unless you live in vows, you just can't get ahead of the game. That's why in the Theravada level of teachings, this first stages of practice, it's not possible to get realizations until you've given up sex, drugs, and rock and roll, until you've given up those actions altogether, because, you know, and then that's why living in vows is so powerful. 24 hours a day, you're ticking over virtue. It's like a rocket boost on your virtue. It's like practical, you know? Are we communicating here? Can you hear this? So intention is the meaning of karma. If there's no intention, there's no virtuous karma either. Let's say I'm walking down the street and I drop 20 pounds, you know, and Natasha picks it up. She's happy. She gets 20 quid. I didn't create any generosity. I didn't give it to anybody. In fact, when I discover it's lost, I'm resentful. So I don't create generosity at all. I have to have the thought, I will give Natasha 20 pounds. Then I create the virtue of generosity. So intention is massive. And there's this lovely saying in Tibetan. Oh, it's tea. Okay, coming. All right, thank you. So as Ruje says, and this is the meaning of karma, everything exists on the tip of the wish, the thought, the intention. Even, you know, I say, even if I'm sitting here, I'm sitting here right now, and in a minute, I guarantee I'm going to have the thought, I will get up and walk out the door, and you'll see me do it. You can guarantee my thought said, I will walk out the door. You'll be shocked to hear if I think I will sit and my legs pick me up. No, not possible. Thought drives everything, but because so much of it's instinctive, we just don't know. So it's very powerful, this point. This is the meaning of karma. We run the show. We just have to realize we're running the show and really be in charge of running the show. You know, this is how we transform ourselves. Intention, volition, will, wish. So let's go and have tea, whatever you have out there. And I'll see you in half an hour. Okay? Thank you.